Ladies, welcome to the Shir. We're starting with Pasuk Dalet. I don't think there's very many copies of the actual text, but it's okay. I gave you the actual new handouts from tonight, but we will also want, before we begin, dedicated to Shoshana Elka Bat Etel Dina, her Refuah Shlema.
Amen.
Okay, so we're up to Pasuk Dalet, and we began it a little bit last week, but let's look at it again. It says, Vayisu lahem nashi. So these really, in a sense, miserably named sons, Mahlon and Kilion, okay, sort of disease and extinction, okay, but at any rate, these terribly named boys of, or children of Naomi, it says, V'yisulem nashim Moaviot. They married Moabite women. Shem ha'achat, the name of one of them was Orpah. Shem ha'shenit, Rut. And the second was Rut. V'yeshvu sham ke'eser shanim. And they lived in this place called Moab for 10 years. Now, what we're going to look at tonight are actually three things that I know that you have, because I just handed it out to you. From last week, and I gave this out again, we're going to look at Moabite women and the men of Israel, a very unpleasant story.
Yes.
We're going to be looking at Orpah. This is going to be Orpah's big
night. Nightmares
this is going to be Orpah's big night. Okay? And that sheet looks like this, also from last week. And then a brand new sheet that none of you had last week, but you only have it this week. It's from Dr. Ziegler. I talked about her last week. From Alienation to Monarchy, trying to understand a problem that Chazal have, particularly with Orpah. Okay, so let's go to where it says, the Moabite women and the men of Israel. So, as you may remember from Parshat Balak, Moabite women and the men of Israel got along all far too well, to the tune of approximately 24,000 Jewish men getting involved with Avodah Zarah and licentious acts with the Moabite women. And as many of you may well remember, what happened to those 24,000 men? They died. Okay? They died. So here's what it says. Israel's, this is just for the interest of going quickly. So this is from Sefer Bamidbar, Perech Chaf Hei, Sukkim 1 to 2. So it says, Israel settled in Shittim, and the people began to commit harlotry, okay, with the daughters of the Moabites. They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods. And we're going to see the Gemara that discusses all of that. And the people ate and prostrated themselves to their gods. Okay? Israel became attached to Baal Peor. And the anger of the Lord flared against Israel. So, as you might suspect, and some of you may have heard this over the years, how was Baal Peor worshipped? Through, it boggles the mind, but one would defecate before the god, and that was its worship service. Now, as you might suspect, the men of Israel didn't just go find a pretty young Moabite girl, and she'd say something along the lines of, hey, you know, like, sure, you look really cute, I like you, but first let's go defecate in front of Baal Peor. It didn't quite happen that way. The story behind this story is found in this Gemara, which is on the bottom of the page. So let's take a look. This Gemara is from Gemara Sanhedrin, Daf Kuf Vav Amud Aleph, and I have very extensively worked on this on CNO translation to make it readable and meaningful. So here's what happened. So Bilam, the great Bilam, who could have been as great as Moshe Rabbeinu, Chazal tell us that. Okay, that's one thing that I know Naomi learned. Okay, you should probably learn about the rest of the story. So, he, Bilaam, said to Balak, the king of Moab, the god of these Jews hates profligate and hedonistic behavior. Okay? So, the first thing you have to remember, you hear the words Moab, what do you think? Profligate and hedonistic and licentious behavior. By the way, Rav Soloveitchik said, and regarding the story of the Kivrot HaTa'ava, he said the Torah hates, as I mean, this is almost verbatim what the Rav said, the Torah hates hedonistic behavior, okay, more than Avodah Zarah itself. Okay? Now, you do understand what we mean by hedonistic behavior, right? So, that means like, think Greek, Romans, and since it's a mixed class, I'll just say partying to excess. You all clearly understand what I'm saying. That's hedonistic behavior. Okay, normal, healthy intimacy is not. It's considered to be part and parcel of the beauty of a Jewish marriage when it's done b'tahara. That's not what we're discussing. We're talking here about hedonism. Okay, so we continue. In addition, they have a great desire for linen garments. Bet you didn't know that about the Jewish men of the time. Come and I will give you advice as to how to defeat them. Okay, again, by the way, I couldn't make this up. This is all straight Gemara. Raise up tents for them, enclosed by hangings, in which you will place prostitutes. Okay?
How can you compare
old women without and young women within? So the old women, of course, are plying the wares of the linen garments. And the young women within were doing something else. Okay? To sell them linen garments. So he, I think, guys, you got to admit, I think I'm doing pretty well, right? So he, Balak, pitched curtain tents from the snowy mountains, meaning Hermon. Anyone ever see Hermon? Isn't it gorgeous? Even in the summer, they're skiing. Okay, as far as Bet Ayeshimot, okay, from north to south, and place prostitutes in them, old women without, young women within. And when a Jewish male drank and was joyful, okay, so in other words, they became slightly what?
Inebriated.
And once, of course, they're inebriated, their guard goes down, and which is not to deny any degree of culpability and responsibility, because if that was the case, would they have been killed? Short answer, no. But they're feeling pretty good, and they're smiling and singing, everything is beautiful. And they would go for a stroll in the marketplace. The old woman would say to him, don't you desire linen garments? Right? And the old woman offered it at its current value. But the young ones behind in the quiet, secure place said, no, 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 don't pay that much. I'll sell it for you for less. Let's make a deal. So this happened two or three times. After that, the young one would say to him, you are now like one of the family. Does that at all sound like, you know, every salesman you've ever heard in your life? Hey, you know, like Ephron to Avraham? Hey, you know, what is it, 200, you know, talents of silver between you and me, or whatever, right? So you're not like one of the family. Sit down and choose what you like. At that point, of course, there was more wine. Gourds of Ammonite wine lay near her. And at that time, non-Jewish wine was not yet prohibited. Of course, the Gemara had to put that in, so you know, everyone doesn't get bogged down in asking the question, how could they eat Stam Yain? You know, well, actually, this is really Yain Nesach. Real Avodah Zarah wine. She would then say, would you like to drink a cup of wine? So, obviously, what happened at this point? What did he do? He said, yes. He already had one glass of wine. Okay? So, once he would drink the wine and became inebriated, that's what Rashi says, his passion would be ignited. And he would declare to her, listen to me regarding my quest for carnal relations. By the way, I wouldn't say this unless Rashi said it explicitly. At that, so don't get blushing. Okay, there's only one guy who gets to blush here. At that moment, she took out an idol from beneath her clothing, and she said to him, worship this. Of course, what did he then respond?
I'm Jewish.
Not me, I can't do that, I'm a Jew. Why? Then she said, remember, he's already half plastered, why should the sack mean anything to you? The only thing you have to do is defecate before it. Sounds pretty easy, especially when you're half drunk. So the Jew, however, had no idea that this was a peculiar form of worship, indeed, and therefore fulfilled a request in order for her to submit to him. So this is the legacy of the Moabite women. Okay? Aren't you glad that we don't go back to Lot? Right? Now, with that in mind, that brings us to Orpah. Now, everyone familiar with the idea of a foil? Okay, so...
You like the foil that you fight?
Well, that's where actually it comes from. So, Orpah is the foil for Ruth. In other words, Ruth is pure, modest, kind, genteel. And the Orpah that we're going to see is anything but. Okay? We'll see this. So please go to this page. Looks like that. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now, we read a moment ago in Pasuk Dalet that there were two Moabite women, Orpah and Ruth. Right? Obviously, Ruth... Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you. As the, if you go down where it says in the Rut Rabbah, okay, actually Lillian mentioned this last week, I think it was. So if you go down to the third line, see what it says, Rabbi Bibi B'Shem Rabbi Ruvain, see that? Rut V'Orpah B'notav She'eglon Hayu. They were sisters, and they were the daughters of Eglon, the king of Moab. So they were princesses. Right? Elimelech had been very wealthy and very considered to be a very fine catch. And so Eglon was more than happy to have his daughters marry the sons of Elimelech.
Even though they were not nice guys?
Well, what's in a name?
Okay.
Okay. I'm not even sure that Eglon would have known really what Machlon and Kilion really meant. Mm-hmm. Okay. But again, the thought was they're wealthy, mm-hmm. and, you know, wealth, you know.
It's everything.
Right. You know, Kesev Metaher Mamzerim, as the expression
know
goes.
That
yes.
Moabim were, like, especially
heinous?
You know, like with the Jewish people, like, you're not allowed to marry a Moabim.
A Moavi, you can't marry. A male Moaviah, you can marry.
Okay, but as a king, wouldn't he have taken offense? And wouldn't he have said, well, if I can't marry, you can't marry my men, why would I let you marry my women?
Again,
you know what I mean?
like many fathers throughout history, what was he looking for as a king?
Money.
A good political marriage. Okay? I mean, just look what happened in England over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Or even in our own day and age. Diana was a political marriage, right? You know, as you well know, her husband never, apparently, retrospectively, loved her, right? But he had to marry the right woman.
Or he could have said, maybe because it's a statement, it's like showing that, you know, you don't believe in God anymore, and you know, it's more like a richest type of thing.
Well, that cannot be denied as at least an interesting theory. Okay? I mean, Eglon here could have been very much like what Shechem, right, and his father wanted to do. Right? Like, okay, now we'll bring the Jewish people in and we'll control them. Anything's possible. I mean, let's put it this way. Eglon never would have gotten Shlishi in any shul that I know. And in all seriousness, he could have very easily have had nefarious ideas. You're right. But I think it was the simple understanding is it was a politically minded marriage with money. Because, right, that would have been the likelihood. Okay, so let's go right to the first idea. Shemachat Orpah. Okay? Now, basically, before we go forward, in the text itself, Orpah and Ruth seem to be no different whatsoever. They both are associated with the word chesed. They both cry when Naomi, and we'll see this inside, when Naomi tells them, leave me, they cry both times. And it's only after tremendous adjuration from Naomi that Orpah decides to leave. So what I'm about to share with you from the Medrash doesn't have textual support, except for the name. So let's look here. Shema Achad Orpah. Okay? Why was she called Orpah? Shehafcha Oref L'chamuta. Because she turned her neck to her mother-in-law. Because if you look at the word Orpah, and you look at the word Oref, they're almost the same. So it's not uncommon at all for the Medrash to darshan a name. And this is one of those Midrashim.
Turn to your mother-in-law.
Excuse?
What's wrong to turn to your mother-in-law?
If you're leaving her.
Oh, turning her back.
Well, it actually literally means the neck.
Turning away.
But when you turn the neck and you show your mother-in-law the back of your neck, you're obviously turning the back as well. Okay? So what basically happens here is that this is what you might call a very legitimate medrash, okay? Because the word Oref and the word Orpah are so much in common, okay? So what does it basically mean to turn your back? So let's go down to Sefer Yehoshua, Perek Zayin, Pasuk Chet. Okay, so that's the pasuk on the bottom of the page. It says, "Biado Shem." Okay, please, Hashem, Ma Omar. What am I supposed to say? Acharei Asher Hafach Yisrael. After the Jewish people have turned Oref, they turned their backs. Lifnei Eivav, which means what? They ran away. They ran away. So the idea of Havcha Oref Chamuta at least fits etymologically. Okay, and we do have there's other psukim too where we have this Havach Oref kind of idea. So basically, it's not bad and it isn't off the chart difficult with this etymology to say, okay, Orpah, Oref, you know, that she was Havcha Oref Chamuta. She just couldn't measure up to who? To Ruth. Fine. Okay. Now, here's our problem. The Tanakh, namely Megillat Ruth, as we're going to see as we go through, has nothing at all pejorative in any way. Nothing negative in any way about Orpah. The Medrash that we just had is the closest thing to saying that as a foil, right, in comparison to Ruth, she wasn't as noble. She wasn't as self-sacrificing. She wasn't as willing to sublimate her needs and desires. Instead, after all that Naomi asks, she listens to Naomi and she goes back to Moab.
Okay? She's not under any obligation to stay with Naomi.
Absolutely true. So the point was just made, I don't know if everyone heard, she wasn't under any obligation to stay with Naomi. Absolutely true. Okay? Which is why what I'm about to share with you is so amazing. This Gemara, this is not, I didn't, for various reasons, and you'd understand once I describe this, but I'm going to describe it using euphemistic language, okay? Basically, what happens is, okay, when she leaves her mother, there's a, in the same medrash,
namely, her mother-in-law.
She leaves her mother-in-law in the same medrash, namely, Rut Rabbah, and in the Gemara in Megillah, Daf Membet, okay, Amud Aleph, she is viewed hyper negatively by Chazal as going back to Moab and participating in all the same kinds of activities that we just read from the Gemara about the original Moab.
But again, at this point, was she Megayer? She was a Megayer at this point.
Well, that's a Makloket. Whether or not Ruth and Orpah had become Giyarot. Okay? There, it's like all things, okay? One side of the argument says yes, one side says no. But be that as it may, according to these sources, and I've really cleaned it up a lot. I mean, you can't even imagine. According to these sources, Orpah goes back and she emulates her,
the old ways,
and lives like a Sodom and Gomorrah existence. That's what she does. Okay. Now, the question is a great question, and you could all ask it as well as I. We have the text. The text has no indication that Orpah is this miserable human being. No indication at all. We have the first medrash. Okay, and again, now you understand why I didn't give you the second medrash. We have the first, you'll just have to take my word for it. We have the first medrash. The first medrash, the etymology works. She wasn't up to the standards of Ruth. Everyone comfortable with that?
Yes.
But then why? Why do Chazal, way off the chart, go out of their way to revile her and declare her to be basically the worst kind of woman possible? So this question was handled, and I think beautifully, by Dr. Ziegler. So Dr. Yael Ziegler, in a book, Ruth, From Alienation to Monarchy, okay, asks this very same question. Okay, and she says in the top, there's no hint of promiscuity and no censure of her character in the actual text itself. Why do rabbinic sources roundly defame Orpah? I think it's a very good question. It's a very good question. Now, I think her analysis is nothing short of brilliant. Here's what she writes. It seems to me that in creating this image of Orpah, which, by the way, does not match the textual image, as both a heartless and licentious woman. Okay? That's how she's presented. So, in other words, you get the heartlessness, she turned her back on her mother-in-law. The licentiousness, well, I've already politely described.
Her mother-in-law kept telling her.
Okay.
Right, she listened to her
mother-in-law. Exactly. So these rabbinic sources.
No.
Now, you ready?
You would think that she has an obligation, let's say, to stay with her parents, to keep it up aim more than her mother-in-law.
Well, all right, let's hold that in abeyance.
I mean, in other words, she'd have to leave her country. She'd have to leave everything behind.
Which she was willing to do already.
She was willing to do if she was married.
She was on her way to Bethlehem.
Right, but as a married woman, you have an obligation to your husband. But if your husband's not there, then don't you have the obligation to your parents?
Well, but in those times, you still may have had obligation to the larger family of your husband's.
Mm-hmm.
Of your husband. Okay, I was thinking Ruth and Orpah. But anyway, here's her suggestion. So it seems to me that in creating this image of Orpah as a heartless and licentious woman, these rabbinic sources are not commenting on Orpah, the persona known as Orpah, but on her choice. Very, very sophisticated analysis. Think about that. In other words, it's hard. It's hard given the text, right? It's hard given the text to say all these mean, nasty, horrible things about Orpah. But what we can focus on is her choice. And you ready? Here's where, again, the long range view of Tanakh comes to the play. Okay, comes to the fore. Because what Dr. Ziegler does is show how everything is interwoven, how Megillat Rut is really playing off so much of what we already know from the rest of Tanakh. Look what she writes. Orpah's decision to return to live in Moab, the spiritual heir of Sodom, sets her on the path of her ancestor, Lot. Why was her ancestor Lot? Because Lot had a son with one of his daughters. And what was his name? Moab. Amazing. As in the case of Lot, Orpah's choice to return to depraved surroundings, which is what Moab was, a society steeped in cruelty and immorality, will invariably determine her future and that of her descendants. So basically, just skipping for the interest of time, okay? So the Midrashim draw a parallel between Orpah and Lot. She turns her back on her unfortunate mother-in-law, and she lives a life, okay, politely stated here, of shameless immorality. Okay, so again, the person of Orpah, as presented in the Megillah, seems blameless, and you'll see it as we go through the text. The choice of Orpah, that is what Chazal were talking about.
It was Yerida.
Exactly. Yerida she'en kamohu. It's as if, I mean, think about it. She was on the highest level, especially if you go to the side that she was a Gioret. She's becoming, you know, to quote Reb Shlomo, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, she was a holy Jewish soul, if you go to the side that she was a Gioret. And she's going from that to Moab. Okay.
Playing devil's advocate.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, we're probably just saying the same thing. But anyway, okay. How long was she married before she became a widow? Do we know?
10 years.
Okay. And how long was she single before that?
I don't know.
So I'm saying if she was, let's say, 20 when she got married.
Unlikely.
Okay.
Because in the Middle East,
okay,
they got
16.
Married a lot younger.
Well, then that was my whole theory.
I mean,
no, because I was going to say, if she was a Moabite and saw what was going on for a lot longer than she was married, so then couldn't you say the same thing, like, B'nai Yisrael were Mitzrim, and they did the whole golden calf, and you're saying because that was their, that's what they were used to. Mm-hmm. So if they went back to do that, why, and then, you know, being written up as terrible people, why was she? If that was
the opposite. I was going to say that maybe playing devil's advocate.
You're being malavid zechut for Orpah. What a tzedekah. Go ahead.
You could play devil's advocate. Like, maybe she was going to be a good influence, like trying to like teach them the better ways.
That would have been good, except for what Chazal say.
Okay.
Okay. And for a variety of reasons, even if you weren't sitting here, for a variety of reasons, I am not going to be more descriptive. All I ask you to do is just imagine the negative parts of today's culture.
Didn't Naomi think that was a possibility that she would go downward? Why would she talk her back into going and leaving?
Well, it's only Naomi's fault.
Okay. So what we're going to see is, and we're going to see it in the text.
Well, isn't she doing?
Naomi had the, in fact, both Naomis had the best intention possible. Okay. Naomi's in the text intention is that why should her daughter-in-law, who was loyal and kind, her daughter-in-laws, loyal, kind, caring, why should they be bereft of a husband for the entire rest of their lives.
Why couldn't they remarry someone else?
But if they weren't a ger, you're supposed to dissuade them anyway. So maybe that's what she was trying
to do. Well, that could also, that's part of it.
But
that's when we get to the famous speech of Ruth to Naomi. But that's not happening tonight.
But if they are a ger, why couldn't they find another person to marry?
Okay, so why did she in fact go back to Moab? That's a very good question. So, in other words, you guys are hitting on a lot of the different arguments that are found in this Machloket. Were they Gerot? Were they not Gerot? But be that as it may. So that's the Orpah. So this is, you know, how there's that Sefer, the Esther you never knew. So this is the Orpah you never knew. And the negative version, the really negative version, you wouldn't have wanted to know. Okay? So at any rate, this is what's happening. Okay, so I think there's a number of things that come out of this that are long-range themes for the Sefer. One is that Megillat Ruth, much more than Megillat Esther, by the way, we did Megillat Esther, I think, very carefully. Megillat Ruth, much more than Megillat Esther, I think, is interwoven. It's really intertwined with so many other themes and stories in Tanakh. Okay, so I'll give you an example, a very good example. And this Dr. Ziegler also points out, and it's a real eye-opener. So you have three instances with women who are unwilling to give up the possibility of a future, where they do unusual actions in order to guarantee continuity. You have Benot Lot, who Chazal think are sitkaniot, because when they get their father drunk and the other behaviors ensue, why did they do it, say Chazal? Because they thought the world was ending. They thought they were in the new Adam and Eve, right? So they wanted to guarantee continuity. Who's the next who does a very unusual action to guarantee continuity?
Well, with
Yaakov and Esav. Well, no, think about Mashiach. Who's the next? Tamar and?
Yehuda.
And Yehuda. Once again, Tamar and Yehuda. Even though some of you may not have learned that story in your yeshiva. But Tamar and Yehuda, right, what does she do? She dresses up as a?
Harlot.
Mm-hmm. Sits in the middle of the road,
yes.
Entices her father-in-law.
No, that was hidden.
Okay.
The son.
Okay. Sits right and entices her father-in-law to eventually help give her sons. Okay. And then the third is who? Ruth and Boaz, because it's inescapable when Ruth goes to Boaz, right, wearing a tahari dress and Chanel number 5 and all of that. It's unmistakable what is about to go on. But why are all those behaviors to go on? In each case, the women said there should be a future for the Jewish people. And because of their selflessness, because did Benot Lot want to be involved like this? No. Did Tamar want to be with her father-in-law?
No.
Oh. Did Ruth, a young, beautiful woman, want to be with Boaz, who's like 85 or whatever, how old he was? Obviously. But what they wanted was a pure future for the Jewish people. And because of their great sense of purity, who eventually comes from all three?
David HaMelech.
Lev Tahar Bara Li Elohim. Right? That's the idea of David HaMelech in a nutshell. And the idea is because each one of these women, it's not just Mishum Nashim Tzidkaniyot Nigalu Avateinu Mitzrayim. But because of these unbelievably righteous women who gave up what it would appear to anyone, right, normal ways of living in this world, who sacrificed, that's why eventually we have David HaMelech. So it's a very powerful story. Very powerful story. Okay, let's go weiter. Now we're up to Pasuk He. Now, not too surprisingly, with names like Machlon and Kilion, they don't last all that long. Okay? Disease and extinction don't go very well together. And V'yamutu gam shnehem. Machlon and Kilion. They both die. Okay? Now, what's the gam? What's the gam? Right? Also. So who died first? Elimelech. So it's not actually, you might not actually have that text with you. Okay. I think I may have left that little pack at home accidentally. Okay? Yeah. So it says, V'yamutu, right? Gam shnehem machlon v'kilyon.
Why couldn't it just say V'yamutu gam machlon v'kilyon? Why did it say shnehem?
Very good.
Would they die at the exact same time?
Well, no. That would be unusual. But what basically it is, Shnehem, and you again, there's a very sensitive nuance there you picked up, is that neither of them deserved to live because they were being dragged down further and further and further into Moabite society. Even though Ruth was just a decade, and at this point Orpah was certainly no different, okay? Let's say that they were not able to live up to the standards of Orpah and Ruth at this moment. That's the best way to say it. So, now you ready? It's interesting. Naomi has lost her name. V'tisha'er ha'isha. And the woman, right, remained Mishnei Yeladeha at a loss of her two sons, Umei Isha, and from her husband. Notice the word Isha and Isha differ only by a dagesh in the hay. So if you ever wondered, is Dituk really important?
Well, it's the Yod.
But also, what happened
right?
to Yod?
Okay, it's minor. But you could write Isha legitimately in modern Hebrew, it's spelled with a Yod. Mm-hmm. Okay, it really is. Okay, so like ish vi ishto and all of that, very easily. So, but the key is so for example, it gets very scary when you read, for example, the Rosh Chodesh Kriya, Isha Reach Nichalach Hashem. So that means a fire offering. Doesn't mean that the woman is being, right, it doesn't. You have to be very careful on the diktuk, okay? But at any rate, what happened? Naomi loses her husband. Naomi loses her son. And Naomi loses her name. That's my own insight. I didn't see that anywhere. But she loses...
She probably felt so bereft of her
identity. Excuse? Go ahead. Yeah.
She probably felt so bereft. Like, who is she now? Her whole family has gone.
Exactly. That's a good insight. In other words, she... Her persona... The main elements of her persona, okay? Always husband, first... Then children, right? As the old adage goes, a good marriage helps you have good children. It doesn't go the other way, right? But and that's in fact why it says the husband first. She lost her husband. Okay, actually, it goes the other way in this case. She lost her sons, and she lost her husband. Okay, but so she has nothing.
Before says that he died.
Yes, because before he died. So that's true, first. Good point. So she basically, given Middle Eastern mores, society, culture, etc., she's in big trouble. There's no one to protect her. At least her sons may have protected her a little bit. You know, they would have, you know, helped, you know, give her a little bit more than her Social Security check. But in this case, nothing. Nothing. Okay? So now, What's very, very, very interesting, this lack of names continues. Mm-hmm. Look in Pasuk Vav. And I found this out when I was reading it. I mean, look, you can see what your text looks like. Here's my text. Okay? So I really got deep into this. And we have the following. It says, V'takom hiva galoteha. She got up and her daughter-in-laws. Now, kaloteha is found in verse Vav. It's found in verse Zion. And it's found in verse Chet. Three times. Now, kaloteha means
brides.
Well, it means, right, but it means daughter-in-laws in this case. But Ruth and Orpah have lost their names too.
Well, they lost their husbands, but they have no children, so...
So in Middle Eastern mores society? Not yet. They could have. And that's exactly what Naomi suggests. Okay? But the key is, and I want you to focus on this, they've all lost who they were. Now, please don't misunderstand. I'm not at all saying that a woman has no value without a husband and children. No. Don't misread that. I'm saying in the biblical period, okay, we must be honest and forthright. We can't take 21st century values and throw them back and say, well, that's what the Bible should have said. That's not true. But in that time,
and that place,
and in that place, they become nameless individuals.
Yerusha, like, women don't get anything.
Say again?
Yerusha, women don't get anything. The
unless there's no sons.
Right.
Then women do inherit.
Salafra.
Correct, menot salafra.
Right, so I'm saying, like, the value of a woman, then, even now, halachically, it's the same.
Yes, except what one is supposed to do. If they have daughters and sons, is that when they write their will, they write the will in such a way that a moment before a person dies, that is not what they did then. That is correct. Right. Because the assumption, good, bad, or indifferent, was that the daughters would get married and they would be taken care of by their husbands. But it was really, we don't have, Baruch Hashem, paternalistic marriages. Okay, in almost all cases, okay, they did. In other words, the wife was taken care of by the husband in a very, straightforward thing. I mean, she didn't work on Wall Street. She wasn't a doctor. Okay, she had a job. Her job was to...
The ketubah's today.
What?
The ketubah's
today.
Today
says the same thing.
Yeah, the ketubah has it.
Take care of everything.
Correct. It's his obligation. Which, by the way, is really a very important idea. So, in other words, halakhically, even if a woman works, okay, it's still part... That doesn't remove the husband's obligation to support her.
Even if she makes more money?
Even if she makes more money. Absolutely so. Okay? So the key here... is that, and I need you to focus on this, is that once Mahlon and Kilion and Elimelech are gone, we enter into a period of psukim where the women have lost their identity. Mm-hmm. They've lost their names. Okay? And names are very important. Okay? I'll tell you a quick story, and with this we'll end, because this is really true. And this happened to me in my own life, and I think you'll find it interesting. The very first job I had in my life, Arlene's heard this story.
So, she's not.
Okay, the very first job I had in my life was working in a pharmacy. I was 16 years old. I just got my working papers, right, because that's the youngest you can be to get working papers. Okay, and I did all the stuff. I dusted the shelves, I cleaned the floor, I stocked the over-the-counter stuff, did all that kind of stuff. Okay. There was a big problem with this particular pharmacist. This is before CVS and Walgreens and all that. It was a private little store, okay, but this is where everybody went in the neighborhood. That's how it was, as you remember, right? The neighborhood pharmacy. He never, ever called me by my name. He called me, "Hey, you." So, at first, I thought, oh, you know, being the big chacham I was at age 16, at first I thought, well, maybe he just couldn't remember, even though he's giving me checks every couple of weeks. He just couldn't remember my name. Okay, so I said to him, "Excuse me, Mr. whatever his name was, I'm sure he's somewhere else today," because he was old then. Okay, I said to him, I said, well, I was 16, so anybody over, you know, 30 looked like ancient, right? So I said to him, "Excuse me, Mr. So-and-so, but please call me David." And this went on for like a couple of weeks, okay, maybe a month or two. And by that point, I even had gotten my license, so I was able to drive the pharmacy car and deliver the drugs. I thought I was just... Right, I was really Mr. Cool, I thought, okay? And each time, I'd come back, and he goes, "Hey, you, do you have the money?" So after a while, as you can imagine, this began to wear on me. So I finally said to him, "Listen, hey, you..." Oh, chutzpah, right? "Hey, Mr. Heyu," he goes, "What?" I said, "Well, if I'm Heyu, you must be Heyu." He goes, "You're fired." And oh. I said, "I'm so sorry, you can't fire me because I've already quit."
Oh. You should have said fire, you couldn't have collected. Right?
And yeah. I walked out. Okay, so I can only tell you.
Also with Auschwitz, what did they do? They tattooed the numbers.
Correct. Correct. So at that point, I'm 16, 17, you know, and I don't know about all that. I don't know about feelings of alienation, you know, lack of recognition of the other. All I know is one thing. My name was not Heyu. Okay? But think about this. I'm telling you a true story in my own life. Now you understand deeply what's going on here. They lost their name. They lost their identity. Okay? Because they became someone else, something else. Or, as Arlene said so well, they lost their status. So, God willing, next week, we'll continue with Pasuk Vav. And we're going to really go a little bit further. I don't think we're going to get up to the big, big, beautiful story where, you know, Ruth says, "Listen, I'm sorry, mother-in-law, I am not leaving." But that's for next week. All right? Be well, and thank you very much for your inspiring comments.